From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm legendary anchorman Bill Curtis, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, everybody. So there's a common saying that everybody deep at heart loves their mother. Except sometimes we decide our actual mothers don't measure up, and so we look for a replacement. Not me, Mom. I am talking about other people.
So this week, as a public service, we're presenting an all-milk show that stands for Mothers I'd Love to Know.
And so we'll start with a woman who was the perfect mother for a whole generation, Carol Brady and the Brady Bunch, or as she is known in real life, Florence Henderson. She appeared with us last year. So we were reading your biography, and it's extraordinarily impressive. Prior to you getting the role of Carol Brady, you were, among other things, the first female guest host for Johnny Carson?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah, well, I go back a long way, Peter.
I can imagine. So you were a theater actress. In fact, you were an award-winning actress here in Chicago. I was proud to read. And then they came to you, presumably sometime in the mid-60s, the creator of Gilligan's Island, had an idea for a show about a blended family, mother with daughters, father with sons. What was your reaction when you first heard about this show?
Well, it was in 1969, and I thought, wow, I really didn't want to do a TV series. You know, I had my own act, and I was performing in Vegas and doing all these exciting things. And my manager said, well, just go down and meet them. I thought it was great, and it was fun. But I thought, well, I guess it didn't sell. And then I got the lead in the movie Song of Norway, and I'm over in Norway filming, and I get a message that the Brady Bunch sold. And so they started the show without me. They did 6 episodes without me, and then I filled in when I got back to the States.
Yes. And the Brady Bunch, as I don't need to tell anybody, well, certainly my age, became like the signal television.
How old are you?
I am old enough to have watched it in the original series. How's that?
You sound like a baby.
Oh, thank you.
I was always curious. They never get into the backstory about how Carol and Mike met. They just was straight up in this relationship. Oh. Was it like a meetup? Because it was pre-internet. This was pre-internet.
Well, they never talked much about our spouses, you know? And people often ask me what happened to my first husband. And I say I killed him.
Really? You were like the stepmother and nobody knew.
That's right. If you don't behave, look out.
Well, you were raising your own family at the same time you were doing the show, right?
Right. I had 4 children. And my youngest when we started was like, oh gosh, 2 or a little less. And sometimes my kids would say to me, you know, how come you don't scream at those kids on television like you do us?
And what did you say?
I said, because they're not my real kids, and you are, and I want you to turn out to be wonderful human beings. And they have. I have 4 of the most incredible children, and I have 5 grandchildren.
And do the grandchildren watch the Brady Bunch?
You know what? I don't sort of encourage it. I mean, they know I'm on television, but I'm just kind of Grandma Flo. You know?
I understand.
That's a rap name.
That's Grandma Flo. That's got the flow.
That's a hip hop name.
You might look into that for your next career. You've had a lot.
Yeah, I'm still hot.
Oh.
Oh. I'll
All right.
You are.
All right.
Bill.
Here we go. I was looking. For a segue into this topic,
yeah,
you handed it to me.
Oh, great. I could read your mind.
I know you could. One of the great myths of my childhood, I should say my adolescence, you know, when you get to like junior high school at my age, somebody said, did you know that Mrs. Brady went on a date with Greg Brady, i.e. you, the actress Florence Henderson? The rumor was dated Barry Williams, I think his name was, who played Greg Brady.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Is it true?
It was the most innocent, sweetest date, and he couldn't even drive without a licensed driver. His brother drove him to my hotel, and then he drove, and I, you know, I was the licensed driver. And
wait a minute, stop. How old was he?
He was about 15.
What? Wait a minute. This is even weirder than it seemed in junior high school. Go on.
Really, it wasn't weird at all, but listen.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, Peter, you're so melodramatic. I think you're a little jealous, maybe.
A little bit, especially because Greg Brady, or rather Barry Williams, wrote a book called Growing Up Brady.
Right.
And in this book, he described you as, quote, and I'm going to go on for a while, so be patient, quote, a totally white-hot babe. I mean, just once, put the apron and the six kids out of your mind and take a good long look at her. Almost from day one, my feelings toward Florence were more carnal than filial, unquote.
Carnal. Carnal. Carnal?
So did he say that you're driving him around because you have a license and he doesn't? And he looks across at you and says, you know, Florence, my feelings for you are more carnal than filial.
No, he wrote that book much later.
Can I ask, what was your Vegas act like, and what did you wear?
Oh, my God. You guys just sound like a horny bunch of old guys.
I am guessing that you run into that a lot.
Oh, gosh. I have a website, and I get, apropos of what you're talking about,
yes,
so many emails saying, you know, I'm in my 40s, and I've been in love with you. You know, everybody thought Marcia was this and that, but you are the one. If you ever are in Vancouver, call me. I'd love to take you to dinner. That is very sweet.
I'm sure it is.
And I answer them.
Do you? What do you say?
Nope.
I say thank you.
Florence Henderson, we've asked you here to play a game. We're calling.
They said you were mad at the Academy. Mad, I tell you.
Now, a few weeks ago, the Annals of Improbable Research, that's a journal, handed out their annual Ig Nobel Awards for achievements in real, if ridiculous, science. We're going to ask you three questions about the far horizons of science.
Oh, my gosh.
Answer two of these questions correctly. You'll win a prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's voice on their voicemail. Bill, who is the immortal Florence Henderson playing for?
Sharon Gavin of Atlanta, Georgia.
All right.
Oh, my gosh. I'll feel terrible if I don't win. Can I send her something?
You may. Or perhaps her husband might be more appreciative. We don't know. Whatever works. But let's play the game.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Here's your first question. The Ig Nobel Prize in Physics this year went to a team in Japan that investigated what? Did they investigate A, what would happen to an average building if Godzilla were really to step on it? B, the actual amount of friction between a person's shoe, a banana peel, and the floor? Or C, how big Angelina Jolie's lips could become before they explode?
You know what? I'm going to go with A.
You're going to go with A. What would happen to an average building if Godzilla were to stomp on it?
Yeah.
Okay. No, actually, it was B, the banana peel.
Oh.
Are you serious?
I am very serious, and so were they. According to their exacting measurements, we can now say for sure that a banana peel on a linoleum floor is slippery.
Ooh.
Now, please.
And funny. You have two more chances, so you can do this.
Okay.
And we always know Mrs. Brady always had a happy ending, so here we go.
Okay.
A special prize was given in Arctic science. And that was given to an international team of scientists who explored what question? A, if ice cubes taken from the polar ice cap can improve a cocktail. B, if putting up big fans on the poles to blow on the Arctic ice can help reverse global warming. Or C, how reindeer behave when they are approached by humans dressed as polar bears.
What was A again?
A was if ice cubes taken from the ancient polar ice cap will actually make your cocktail taste better.
I think I have to go with that.
That's like a Dean Martin kind of question.
That is a Dean Martin kind of question.
Can I weigh in? It doesn't.
Yeah, help me out.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that sounds wasteful. What was the second one?
Blowing a fan is going to help global warming.
Yeah, that sounds ridiculous.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other one was the
last one was how reindeer behave when they are approached by humans wearing polar bear suits.
I'm liking that one. I'm liking that one.
Oh, I think I have to stay with A.
Really? I want to point out, you may not know this, but Amy is an advice columnist.
Yeah.
She's
yeah,
very
I like
wise.
I like number three.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
Hey.
It turns out, and this is again according to this very scientific study, that reindeer are kind of freaked out when people dress as polar bears approach them. All right, Florence, get this one right, you win. The Public Health Prize went to a team that tried to determine if doing what was detrimental to your mental health. Is it A, trying to get your cable hooked up, B, playing the computer game Candy Crush, or C, owning a cat?
Wow.
I own a cat.
It's bad for your mental health.
Yes. And Roy just said he owns a cat, which to me is sort of proof right there.
Yeah. That's true.
Well, all right, let's go with number three.
Yes, that's right. So they publish a number of studies that involve various things like parasites that cats sometimes have, but the short answer is yes, cats make you crazy. Bill, how did Florence Henderson do on our quiz?
Well, Florence and Amy got two out of three.
Yay, thank you.
Florence Henderson, what fun to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
For being with us. Take care.
Bye.
Support for this podcast and this message are provided by Stamps.com. Going to the post office takes up valuable time, and leasing a postage meter is too expensive. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for all of your letters and packages using just your computer and printer. For a no-risk trial and bonus offer for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me listeners, go to Stamps.com today. Click on the microphone at the top of the home page and type in WAIT. That's Stamps.com. Enter WAIT. WAIT.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. So this week, we are taking a moment to thank our mothers by talking about the people we wish were our mothers.
This is why our mothers are so disappointed in us.
Next up, the mother your mother warned you about. Alice Cooper isn't a mother. He isn't even a woman. But as it turns out, he was a hell of a showman.
Alice joined us in 2013 and told us about how he and his band figured out their act back in the 1960s.
Well, you know, like every other band in the 60s, we learned how to play Beatles songs and Rolling Stones songs. I mean, that was all rock and roll 101. And then we just, you know, when we heard the Yardbirds and the Who, then we started stretching out and learning those songs. Added a little bit of Dracula in there and some West Side Story. And, you know, as long as we could get parents to hate us, we were just fine.
Really? So how did the whole Alice Cooper thing start? It wasn't your first band, and Alice Cooper was actually at first the name of the band?
Yeah, well, actually, the idea was, I just said we need a definitive villain in rock and roll, and that's got to be Alice Cooper. And I was more than happy to play that part. But in order to do that, you have to don't just play hit records. You have to have the image. You have to have the show built around it. And you have to pretty much annoy every parent organization in America.
Yeah.
But, you know, to put it in perspective, here was the Summer of Love, and it was like, you know, all this la-la-la music. And these artists were really popular, but they were, you know, good-looking guys and good-looking gals. And the outcasts, the weirdos, the my people had nothing to relate to. And then Alice Cooper comes out, and he's in a dress, and he's got makeup on, and he's screaming his heart out. And, you know, it was like a star-belly sneech finding the rest of the star-belly sneeches.
Yeah.
You know? He was the hero of the outcasts, the weirdos, the losers. So
there was the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, you know, 90%. I was glad to take the outcast 10%.
Sure.
It ended up that the outcast 10% was a lot more people than people realized.
And when did you start dying at the end of your shows?
Well, we figured that if you are a villain, I don't care if it's Shakespeare or Vampire Diaries, the bad guy needs to get it in the end.
Yeah.
You know, and we felt that, that Alice is playing the villain through the whole show, and there's baby parts flying and, you know, things. So that character needs to be punished.
I'm sorry, back up. Baby parts flying?
Well, sure.
You know, it wasn't really baby parts. It was doll parts.
Sure.
You know, but of course the audience, there was no internet then, so everything was word of mouth. And by the time it got back to mom and dad, they were live babies.
Yeah.
You know?
But in his defense, that baby was a jerk.
One of the most famous stories about you from pretty much when you started was that you once bit the head off a chicken on stage, or a live chicken.
You know, and that was one of the great moments where I'm on stage. We went on between John Lennon and Yoko and the Doors, and 60,000 people at the Toronto Peace and Love.
Sure, of course. No better place to bite a head off a live chicken, but
right,
go on.
Well, you know, we had to bring some drama to it. And we're doing the very last song. We open up these pillows, these white pillows with CO2 cartridges, and two pillows will fill Madison Square Garden. It looks like a snowstorm up there.
Right.
I look down, and there's a white chicken on the stage. Now, I didn't bring the chicken, and nobody I know on stage brought it, but there he was. I'm from Detroit, okay? I've never been on a farm in my life. It had wings. It had feathers. It should fly. So I kind of tossed it into the audience, figuring somebody would take it home as a souvenir. And chickens don't fly as much as they plummet.
Yes.
And this is the Peace and Love Festival. Next day on the, in the press, Alice Cooper kills chicken and drinks blood. Frank Zappa called me up. He was producing us at the time, and he says, "Did you kill a chicken on stage last night?" And I went, "No." And he says, "Well, don't tell anybody. They love it."
Well, Alice Cooper, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling.
So what if you had bit the head off that chicken?
Oh, great. I love it.
We know, we're willing to believe that you didn't really bite the head off that chicken, like you said. But if you had bit the head off that chicken, it might have gone on to fame and fortune, just like Mike the Headless Chicken did back in the 1940s. We're going to ask you three questions about the real, true story of Mike the Headless Chicken. Get two questions right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Bill, who is Alice Cooper playing for?
Lyndon Alec of Bozeman, Montana.
Here we go. Mike the Headless Chicken was born, or reborn, I should say, as a headless chicken, when his owner, Colorado farmer Lloyd Olson, got a little clumsy with his axe. What messed up the usually expert Mr. Olson? A, he was moved at the last minute by the beauty of this chicken. B, he was worried about impressing his mother-in-law. Or C, on the backstroke, he whacked himself on the butt and it threw off his aim.
Wow. Those are three really stupid answers. I would say number two.
And you'd be right. That's what happened. Although, what happened was, his mother was coming for dinner. And this was in the days, of course, you didn't go down to the grocery store. You wanted the chicken. You went out. You picked up a chicken. You cut off his head. You cooked him for dinner. And he wanted to make sure that the chicken had a long neck, because his mother liked chicken neck. And he
That's right, yeah.
He went a little bit long and left just enough head on that chicken that it still lived and became Mike the Headless Chicken.
Wow.
In an interview about Mike, who went on to fame and fortune as an amazing miracle, Farmer Lloyd said, which of these? A, you'd think he'd run around like, you know, a chicken with his head cut off, but he's quite graceful. B, I keep trying to make a mate for him, but they just die. Or C, he's a fine specimen of a chicken, except for not having a head.
I would say number three.
He's a fine specimen of a chicken, except for not having a head?
Right.
You're right. In fact, Farmer Lloyd was right. Mike the Headless Chicken grew to 8 pounds, not including his head, which was not included. All right. As I said, this bizarre creature became a huge hit at, you know, carnivals, sideshows, freak shows, that sort of thing, became famous. There are pictures of him sold. He traveled all over the country. And people like to see him walk around and peck at the ground and flap his wings, even without a head. But he met his end in the same way many successful performers do. How? A, he was shot by an obsessed fan, who was also a somewhat hungry fan. B, he died in a motel room from overindulgence. Or C, complications during cosmetic surgery, specifically a headoplasty.
The first answer was what? He did.
He was shot by an obsessed fan who was also a little
hungry.
No,
that never happened.
Right.
I'd say number three.
You're going to go, complications during cosmetic surgery,
ahead of plastic? Yeah.
No, the answer was B, on tour. He was staying at a motel in the Arizona desert. He got hungry in the middle of the night, tried to swallow a grain of corn, and choked because he was a headless chicken.
There's a song there somewhere, and I think I may have to write it.
Absolutely. You're the man. Bill, how did Alice Cooper do in our quiz?
Well, I got two right. Alice, congratulations on that. Two out of three.
Wow. Well done. Alice Cooper, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Started the show with Florence Henderson, one of TV's great moms. Her rival for the crown of best fictional mom ever, Shirley Jones of the Partridge Family, joined us in November of 2013.
She was a huge star long before her TV career, but it all came about, more or less, by accident.
Well, you know, I wanted to be a veterinarian. I was an only child in a small town of Smithton, Pennsylvania, adored animals, raised everything in the world, you know, and decided that was going to be what I was going to do, but I could sing, and so I would sing everywhere and be, you know, went to Pittsburgh Playhouse and did some drama and dancing and so forth. Still wanted to be a vet. Went to New York on my way to college and went to an audition for Rodgers and Hammerstein. I sang for the casting director, and he said, I'd like you to sing for Mr. Rodgers, and I didn't even know who Richard Rodgers was then.
Right.
I was 18, and he came down the aisle, and he said, Miss Jones, and I said, what'd you say your name was again? He said, Richard Rodgers. Never to forget that moment. I sang for him, and he said, would you wait? I'm going to call my partner, Oscar Hammerstein. I waited, and my pianist had to leave, and so he said, don't worry, we'll figure something out. Well, there was a symphony across the street, and he said, Miss Jones, you could come over and sing with the symphony for Oscar Hammerstein. I'd never heard a symphony, seen one, or sang with one, certainly.
So you walk into New York. You're there on a college trip.
Exactly right.
You go in on audition on a lark, and the next thing you know, you're singing for Rodgers and Hammerstein,
right,
the guys themselves, with a symphony orchestra.
Right.
And I want the kids out there who are thinking about a career in show business, that's how it works for pretty much everybody.
Not really, but...
And you went into one of their shows in New York, but
I went into South Pacific the last 3 months of the Broadway show, and then they sent me to California to screen test for the role of Laurie in Oklahoma, and that's what happened.
And so the next thing you know, now you're 21, and you were playing the lead in the musical adaptation of the biggest musical in American history.
Mm-hmm.
Again, pretty much standard. I love the fact that you also tell in the book that... that Richard Rodgers became first in a long line of show businessmen to hit on you.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, he asked me up to his office, and I was sitting there, and he put his arm around me, and then I suddenly saw him go and lock the door, you know, in the office, and came over, put his arm around me again, and he said, do you have a boyfriend? And I said, oh, yes, I'm engaged. Of course, that was not true. I said, I'm engaged. He's waiting for me. And he said, oh, really? Well, it's too bad. You won't be there for a long time. I said, I know. And I said, well, you know, I'm so thrilled to be here. And I said, the fact that I have a wonderful grandpa right next to me.
Oh! Harsh. another generation, I guess this includes my generation, first heard of you from the Partridge Family. This was a sitcom in which you played the mother of a traveling musical family.
Right.
And you played the mother of the lead singer was played by your stepson.
Right.
Which must have been a little odd.
Well, not at all, no.
Oh.
No, I was the first person cast, and they came to me and said, Shirley, how do you feel about your stepson, David Cassidy? And I said, why? And they said, we're thinking of him to play, you know, the role in the show. So I said, he'd be perfect for it. That's great. And they said, oh, good, we want to make sure you have a good feeling about him.
Yeah.
I said, of course. And I went on the set, and they were testing him. And he turned around, he saw me, he said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm your mama.
And then, of course, David Cassidy, who played your son, your stepson in real life, became a huge teen idol.
Huge, huge teen idol.
That, and then your other son, Sean Cassidy.
Yes, became another teen idol.
That must have been odd.
It was very odd, yes.
What is it like to have sons who become international sex symbols for 14- and 15-year-olds?
Well, for me, you know, I mean, I was one of these mothers that said, you got to go to college, kids. You got to be a doctors and lawyers. Forget the damn show business. But when it happened to David, Sean looked at me and he said, Ma, listen, if he can do it, I can do it. And literally walked out the door and did it.
Wow. So I knew you, like, again, in these wonderful, innocent roles. I never got around to Elmer Gantry somehow. And then, of course, the Partridge Family. We were playing a sweet all-American mom. And I'm reading your book. And your book has, shall we say, a lot of adult material.
Yes, it does.
Things, I will tell you, fascinating read.
I know.
Never wanted to know.
I know. Well, that's the point. When they came to me and asked if I would write a book about my life, and I thought, do I want to do this? I mean, then I thought to myself, why not? I mean, if they know me as you know, Oklahoma Carousel, Mrs. Partridge, all those characters, why can't they know me as me? And I thought, I want to tell people who I am, the life that I had as a child, being married all my life. I mean, you know, I never had affairs with a lot of men. That was not my case. But I was very devoted to the two husbands I've had.
And your devotion led you to do some very interesting things,
That's
which you
exactly
describe in
right.
detail.
Absolutely.
Everything you're saying makes perfect sense, and you have every right and even an obligation to let your public know who you really are and what
Absolutely.
Your life was like.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I did not want to think about marrying the librarian getting freaky. That's so there's now I have to, you know?
But of course. It's called life.
Yes, I guess so. Anyway, Shirley Jones, we're delighted to talk to you, and we've invited you here to play a game that this time we're calling
Look, it's the Partridge Family.
Okay.
Get them.
So you played a partridge on the Partridge Family, as we've discussed.
That's
but
right.
we missed the episode where rich people stalked you with dogs and tried to shoot you with shotguns.
Oh.
Partridge shooting is a big sport, especially in England.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to ask you three questions about the sport of partridge shooting. Get two right, you'll win our game. Carl, who is Shirley Jones playing for?
Shirley is playing for Junette Sheen of Los Angeles, California.
All right. Ready to play?
Yes.
All right. First question. You begin. If you're a partridge shooter, if you are what is known as a gun, that's what they call you.
Yes.
You begin your day with a ritual known as what? A, the peg draw. B, the partridge cartridge. Or C, the ritual sacrifice to Moloch.
C.
The ritual sacrifice to Moloch. I love the idea of British aristocrats and tweeds with broken shotguns worshipping at the great idol of the Babylonian god Moloch.
Right.
That's you sound very confident here. It's the peg draw is what it was.
Oh.
Your peg is your... Yeah, your peg, you see, is the place in line where you stand with your gun and you draw to see where you will stand.
I see.
All right.
Okay.
You still have two more chances. So if you go and you shoot, if you are a gun on a partridge shoot, you will be assisted by a person known as a what? A, Lord High Executioner. B, the stuffer. Or C, the fluffer.
B,
the stuffer. You're right. Very good. The stuffer is also known as the loader. He loads a fresh shotgun and hands it to you so you never miss a chance to kill
right.
a bird.
All right.
This is very exciting. You got one right with one to go. If you get this last one right, you will win. What does the well-appointed gun wear on his day on the line of shooting partridges? A, a flexible pair of breeks. B, a sporty funicular. Or C, a wide-brimmed uvula.
Oh. Pair of breeks.
You're right, a pair of breeks.
Nice.
Breeks. Breeks are the terms for the special shooting trousers that guns
right.
wear. Carl, how did Shirley Jones do in our quiz?
Pretty good, Peter. She got two right, and that's good enough to win for Junette Sheen.
Shirley Jones is a star of stage and screen and has been for decades. Her book, Shirley Jones, A Memoir, is out now. Get it, read it. You will never forget it. Shirley Jones, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and this message comes from AT&T. With AT&T, the network is on demand, the office is mobile, and the cloud is designed for high security. Learn more at AT&T.com/focus.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Bill. It's all about mother this week. We are more dedicated to mom than Norman Bates ever was, and we have stuffed as many of them as we can into this hour.
Elizabeth Gilbert doesn't have any children herself, but with her book, Eat, Pray, Love, she is the spiritual mother to millions. Easy thing to be when you don't have to drive them all to soccer practice.
Elizabeth, who joined us in September of 2014, started by telling us about her zillion copy selling book. There might be one or two people out there listening who neither read Eat, Pray, Love nor saw the film with Julia Roberts. So could you describe it briefly for them?
There might be one or two men.
Yes.
Yes. To be very specific.
Who were afraid to admit it to their significant
other. No, my wife and I sat in the warm morning sun feeding each other grapes and read it to each other. Now, actually, I'm sitting between two women. I can't speak freely.
Well, so this is, you, as I said, you were going through a life crisis. Your marriage ended. It was not going well. You said, I'm hitting the road. You went to Italy and then Indonesia and India. So, and then you wrote a book about these, about the lessons that you learned. Am I summarizing it correctly?
Yeah, you just did it beautifully.
Thank you.
Yeah, I ate my way through India and... actually, ate my way through Italy. What am I saying?
I was about to say, you haven't read the book, have you?
I haven't, actually. I did it all in upstate New York. I was just hoping I wouldn't get busted.
And this, didn't you sort of create a movement of women finding themselves?
I hope so. That wouldn't be such a terrible movement to be responsible for. I certainly didn't set out to do that. My first books, by point of comparison, sold upwards of dozens of copies each. Yeah. So I was not in any way prepared for that kind of a response, but I'm so surprised by it, but delighted by it.
One of the things that's happened, and this was probably something you didn't expect when you were a working magazine writer, is that you've become kind of a self-help figure. You just did a tour with Oprah, right?
Yeah, that's been an amazing thing. That's sort of like getting a phone call from the president.
It's better than that.
Yeah.
President has to call people. Oprah chooses. What is it like being part of like an Oprah revival meeting?
I have to say it's amazing. Being around her is really remarkable. She's a great person, but she's also a good person, and I don't think that's often always necessarily the case. I feel so earnestly respectful of her that I can't even make funny jokes about it. Isn't that terrible?
For my purposes, it's awful.
I know.
Thanks a lot. let's leave Oprah alone then and ask you about yourself. Because you obviously wrote this book, and of course because it was a big bestseller or because it was wonderful, they made a movie out of it with Julia Roberts playing you. And if I'm not mistaken, Javier Bardem playing the man who ultimately is now your husband. Is that right?
Yeah, we look like that, so it works out really well.
Is it? I mean, these are two very attractive people. Is it weird to just sit in a movie theater, presumably a nice one with nice clothes on because it's the premiere, and you're sitting there with your husband and you're watching yourselves being played by Julia Roberts and Javier Bardem, and do you look at each other and start looking each other up and down and going, wait a minute, I kind of got the short end of the stick here.
Can I have my avatar, please?
Exactly.
it's interesting that you mentioned watching it in a movie theater with your clothes on. It's probably more fun to watch it at home with your clothes off and just pretend you actually are them.
Really? We were talking to Rick Steves, the travel guru, about whether or not places he recommended got overrun. And I'm wondering if the same thing applies to you. You write about specific places and things you did in Italy and Indonesia and India. And are those places now being overwhelmed by women in their early 30s who are trying to replicate your experience? Where's my Javier Bardem, they shout.
Well, that's really funny because my husband lived in Bali for a long time, and he still lived there for a while when we were together after the book was written. And every once in a while, he would run into some woman there, and she'd say she was there because of Eat, Pray, Love, and that she was looking for a Brazilian man. And he would just say, why don't you just go to Brazil? That's where most of them are.
I've heard. Well, Elizabeth Gilbert, so much fun to talk to you. But we have asked you here to play a game we're calling
I Refuse to Eat, Pray, or Love.
So you wrote Eat, Pray, Love. Naturally, we're going to ask you three questions about dieting, blasphemy, and hate.
Oh, my God. That's the name name of my next memoir.
You see? Answer two of these three questions correctly, and you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle, his voice on their voicemail. You ready to play?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, Bill, who is Liz Gilbert playing for?
Bud Kluwek of La Mesa, California.
All right. Bud is waiting on you. Here we go. We're going to start. We're going to start with dieting, or starve, if you will. When it comes to dieting, Atkins and Paleo get all the press, but in 2010, a Kansas State nutrition professor lost 27 pounds by eating nothing but what? A, Twinkies, B, diet books, and by that I mean the actual books, or C, airline peanuts.
I think you could do well with airline peanuts, but when I listen to this show, I always want people to guess the most fun answer, so I'm going to say Twinkies.
In fact, it was Twinkies, yes.
Awesome.
He was trying to prove a point. Doesn't matter what you eat, as long as you eat less calories. He ate one Twinkie every 3 hours and also some Little Debbie snack cakes for a variety. Despite the success of the diet, he says, I'm not geared to say this is a good thing to do. All right, that's good. That was starve. Next up, blasphemy. One way you can avoid blaspheming is with what linguists call a minced oath. You know, like gosh, darn, instead of its blasphemous alternative. Here is another thing that you can say rather than, you know, invoke the Almighty in an unpleasant way.
Okay.
A, well, Dad, sizzle it. B, great Wertheimer's Majesty. Or C, Jesus' favorite sweater vest.
I'm going to go with B.
You're going to go with B, which was great Wertheimer's Majesty?
Yes.
Bless you.
No, I'm not.
No.
I know that tone from you, Peter. I'm going to go with A.
You're going to go with A, Dad Sizzle?
Dad Sizzle it. Yep.
You're right. My tone gave me away. Although people used to be able to say Dad Sizzle it. I, however, am going to say great Wertheimer's Majesty whenever I hit my thumb with a hammer. All right. Lastly, we've done starve, we've done blaspheme, now hate. We found an example of a true hate story for the ages. Is it A, a brother and sister who haven't spoken in 73 years because she ate his donut? B, the last two Jews left in Kabul, Afghanistan, who each had a synagogue just so they could keep the other guy out of it? Or C, a guy who goes to every single game played by the San Diego Padres for the last 8 years, home and away, just so he can boo one player?
Wow. I'm going with C, because I think sports hatred is a deeper kind of hatred than any other human hatred there is.
It is a deep hatred, but not as much as the hatred felt by the last two Jews of Afghanistan.
No!
It's true. They absolutely hated each other, and they stayed in two different synagogues, and they refused to go into the others. And they ended up living in the same building, but they still wouldn't talk to each other until one of them
died. That's beautiful.
Isn't it great? Bill, how did Liz Gilbert do in our quiz?
2 out of 3.
Well
That's
done,
a winner.
Liz. Yes, very good. Elizabeth Gilbert is a New York Times bestselling author. Thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What
Thank
fun to talk
you.
To you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Our next mother, Dame Edna Everidge, is actually a mother. But the greater question is whether she actually exists.
People have their doubts about that, especially because she always appears in the vicinity of Australian comedian Barry Humphries.
Dame Edna was in fine form when she appeared on our show in January of 2015 and was open about her mothering techniques.
Yes,
Thank
yes, Damon.
It's beautiful to talk to you and to the viewers. And you know, I call them viewers.
You do.
Because a lot of people, especially confused people, watch the radio.
They do. It's wise. Sometimes it moves, in my experience.
My mother watches it in the hope that someone will pop out of it.
You are, I think, where shall we begin? You are certainly Australia's most famous citizen. Is that
well,
correct?
I am, and I'm a very close friend of the Queen.
Yes.
And she doesn't really make a move without me. I have a lovely little apartment in Buckingham Palace.
Do you?
I've got a key, and she's given me my own shelf in the refrigerator.
That's very sweet of her. We understand, though, that you do have you children, though. You're a mother.
Oh, I've got three children. I lost one.
Oh.
It was abducted by a rogue koala bear, a feral koala bear.
That's terrible, but somewhat adorable.
But it was, well, I mean, I'm looking, every time I pass a eucalyptus tree, I look up, you know.
Now,
it might be there.
Hello. Dame Edna, what is your parenting style? Do you consider yourself, as we've been saying of late here in America, a tiger mom? Did you demand a lot from your children?
No, I don't. I've decided the secret of parenting is benevolent neglect. It is. And I put my family last.
Really?
Because if you don't, if you put them first, they never thank you. You'll never get a word of thanks from them.
Right.
You've got to do what Peter has got to do.
True.
And you have done wonders, and you've made those lovely films, The Dirty Dancing and Havana Nights.
That's Dame Edna.
Who told her about the internet?
However did you find out about me?
Because, look, darling, I followed your career for many, many years.
I'm flattered and honored.
And you are very, very bright and interesting.
Well, thank you, Dame Edna.
And really, you don't need to do this show.
What?
There are better things to do.
Well, Dame Edna, we are so, I think, honored is the only word to talk to you.
No,
we have asked.
You don't have to overdo it, Peter. I know you too well.
Oh, you're right.
I don't hear a single note of sincerity.
All right, Dame Edna, we're moderately happy to talk to you. We've asked you here to play a game that this time we're calling.
I've heard about
this. Oh, yes. This time we're calling the game
I Won't Be Back.
Now, you're on your farewell tour, one of just a few, and we have no doubt that this time you mean it sincerely, but other people are not so honest about their farewells. We're going to ask you three questions about other farewell tours taken from an article we found on RollingStone.com. And if you get two questions right, you'll win a prize for one of our listeners. Bill, who is Dame Edna Everidge playing for?
Kate Ree of Berlin, Germany.
So there you are.
Good heavens!
I know, Germany, no less. Here's your first question, Dame Edna. The heavy metal band Judas Priest, perhaps you know of them.
You've lost me already.
I know. They're a musical group of some kind. They did their farewell tour in 2011, and then they toured again 2 years later. When asked why they came back after going away, guitarist Glenn Tipton of the band said which of these? Did he say A, quote, "You try living at home with my wife"? B, quote, "I realized no one threw their underwear at me when I was retired." Or C, quote, we lied.
C.
You are correct, Dame Edna. We lied.
I said C.
Yes, very good choice.
I said C because you wouldn't expect a very witty reply from a heavy metal band.
That's true. Next question, Dame Edna. When the band Nine Inch Nails announced their farewell tour in 2009, band leader Trent Reznor explained their decision to quit how? Again, three quotes. Was it A, quote, "Basically, I came around to agree with all the parents. It is just noise." B, quote, "I realized it was time to quit when I couldn't fit into the pants anymore." Or C, quote, "I'd never want to be Gene Simmons, an old man who puts on makeup to entertain kids like a clown going to work," unquote.
I think it's C again.
You are right,
wow.
Dame Edna. I was going to explain who Gene Simmons was. He, of course, is the leader of the band Kiss, but I presumably you know that.
Well, someone knows it.
We have one last question for you. Let's see if you can be as perfect in this as you are in so many things. Elton John, who is, of course, still performing, first announced that he would stop touring as a musician back in 1977. He later said that that decision was due to what? A, he was distraught after his single, "No, Wait, This Is Your Song," failed to sell. B, he was taking a lot of drugs. Or C, he didn't want to be like Gene Simmons.
Number one
was he was distraught after his single, "No Wait, This Is Your Song," failed to catch on with the public.
That is my choice.
Oh, I wish it were true. Sadly, it was B. He said that he quit only because he was taking a lot of drugs and used to have hallucinations.
Oh, dear.
Yes, I know. But he regretted the decision and, of course, has been performing
ever since. Well, that's
not
my reason. I'm telling you that.
No, no. Well, what is your reason? Why are you giving up the glory of the footlights?
Do you know, you're beginning to talk me into doing another farewell tour.
Bill, how did Dame Edna do on our quiz?
Well, she did so well, I think you should rethink your farewell tour, Dame Edna.
Oh, no, I can't at the moment. But the fact of the matter is that whenever someone says, you know this well, Peter.
Yes.
When they say, we're very excited about your show, you know it's finished.
I know. I always say the entertainment industry was founded when it was discovered that enthusiasm was free.
You see, you have a talent far too rich.
I can only agree. Dame Edna, thank you so much. Good luck. We look forward to talking to you again.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Support for this podcast comes from Talenti Gelato and Sorbetto. I want to take a minute to make a correction. My good friend and colleague Peter Sagal told you to eat your Talenti Gelato before the sun explodes in a supernova. Now, as you know, the sun is not a supernova and will not explode. Peter should have told you to eat your Talenti Gelato. Maybe one of their new flavors, like oatmeal raisin cookie, salted peanut caramel, or coffee toffee. Well, whatever kind of Talenti you like, eat that before the sun becomes a red giant and expands to 70 times its current size. When that happens, you want to be eating something delicious because it's going to get really, really hot. To find Talenti at a store near you, go to talentigelato.com.
Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, benevolent overlord. Philip Goedeker writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our assistant house manager is Tyler Green. Our intern is I Wish I Had, Jesse's Beatend. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Special thanks to John Zajac and Les Dolarchik at Chase Bank. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Eva Waltrover and Miles Dernboss. Our technical direction is from Lorna White. Our CFO is Andy N. Our production coordinator is Robert Newhouse. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. And the executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Michael Danforth. Thanks to all of our panelists, our listener contestants, and of course, our scorekeeper emeritus, Carl Castle. I am Peter Sagal, and we will see you next week with an all-new version of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. This is NPR.